I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man.
I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how are you doing, podcats? This is Adam Buxton here, and I am currently staring at my dog friend Rosie, a black Whippet Poodle cross, and she is sniffing at a spot in one of the hedgerows here on the Norfolk farm track where we are walking. Rosie, come on, let's walk up this way. Come on, how about a fly past even? What about that?
No, I'm just going for a lope. It's Sunday. It's not fly past time.
Lope past. Don't know if you heard that. Didn't find anything in the hedgerows, I guess. But it's exciting for Rosie because everything is just crazily bushy, exploding with life. It being late June 2022. Anyway, shut up, Buckles, and tell the podcats a little bit about podcast number 182, which features a rambling conversation with English writer and cultural historian John Higgs. Here's a few Higgs facts for you. John, currently aged 51, was born in the Warwickshire town of Rugby, grew up in North Wales, and now lives with his family in Brighton on England's south coast. That's for our foreign listeners who perhaps aren't so familiar with the geography of England. John is the author of a couple of idiosyncratic novels and several non-fiction books that offer fresh and frequently strange perspectives on various pivotal events and figures in modern cultural and countercultural history. He's written about the psychologist and psychedelic neuronaut Timothy Leary, art and music pranksters the KLF, 18th century romantic poet, artist and visionary William Blake, and his new book considers the British psyche through the lens of James Bond and the Beatles. My conversation with John was recorded face-to-face in the front room of his house in Brighton on a rainy afternoon in October of last year, 2021. We talked about John's book, The KLF, Chaos, Magic and the Band Who Burned £1 Million, published in 2013. One of the people that John has become fascinated by over the years and writes about in connection with some of the ideas behind the KLF is Robert Anton Wilson, who became a key figure in the world of Discordianism. Now, we mentioned that word a couple of times in the conversation, and though John explains a little bit about it, I thought it would be worth just giving you a bit more background in case you're not familiar with it. Discordianism is often described as an invented religion created by a couple of Californian writers in the late 1950s. It was intended to satirize various aspects of human belief systems and encouraged people to break out of the so-called mind tunnels through which we tend to view the world. In the mid-1970s, Robert Anton Wilson and journalist Robert Shea collaborated on the sci-fi novels The Illuminatus Trilogy, which incorporated themes of Discordianism and was intended to poke fun at the world of conspiracy theories. Ironically, however, it ended up convincing many people that those theories were true, and later, in the internet age, encouraged people to disappear down rabbit holes that led to movements like QAnon being taken seriously at the very highest levels of government. For more on Robert Anton Wilson, The Illuminatus Trilogy, and a non-toxic perspective on conspiracy theories in general, I've put a link to an interview John Higgs conducted in 2015 with legendary comic book writer Alan Moore. Anyway, as for my conversation with John, we focus less on conspiracies and more on the weirdness of some of the films and TV shows we grew up enjoying in the 80s and particularly in the 90s. We also talked about John's book, The Future Starts Here, Adventures in the 21st Century, which regular listeners may have heard me mention once or twice before on the podcast, particularly with reference to how that book highlights the dangers of feeling obliged to talk about the future in exclusively pessimistic terms. By the way, that part of my conversation with John does contain some spoilers for the 2015 film Tomorrowland. I don't think it'll ruin the film for you if you haven't seen it and you are hoping to see it. But if you are concerned, skip ahead 5 minutes when you hear me first mention the film and you should be fine. And finally, we also talked about John's latest book, Love and Let Die, Bond, the Beatles and the British Psyche, which is due to be published in September this year, 2022. Very much looking forward to that. Back at the end with a bit more waffle, but right now with John Higgs. Here we go.
You've had an interesting career, John. Did you start out in children's TV?
I started out, I guess, as a runner on The Big Breakfast.
Did you?
Yeah, back in the early 90s.
Yeah. So who was presenting at that point?
Oh, it was just after the golden age.
Yeah.
Chris Evans had gone, but it was still sort of...
Vaughan and Denise Van Outen, was it?
Yeah, it was around then, yeah. But I was more just sort of in the office doing the post than, you know, anywhere interesting.
Was it an enjoyable experience?
It was an eye-opening one. It was a whole bunch of people, the likes of which I'd not really mixed with before.
Right.
Basically public schoolboys on cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
I had no awareness of what this was like, or I'd not encountered any of these sort of type of people before. And I didn't really fit in, and I couldn't really get my head around it. And they're all so pleased with themselves about these ideas that they were sort of coming up with. And I just thought, these are terrible. They're these most obvious dumb things. But because they were all so, you know, congratulatory and everyone was like so excited by it all.
This is mid-90s.
Yeah, mid-90s, yeah.
And the TV world in the mid-90s, especially in the UK, was a very odd place.
It was very strange, yeah. It was this whole raft of independent companies that just sort of sprung up.
The effects of postmodernism in full swing, or at least getting to be in full swing, like and that stuff from the US drifting over as well, shows like Seinfeld,
yeah,
and Larry Sanders and The Simpsons, that sort of deconstructionist ethic that was starting to be assimilated by TV in the UK. Certainly we were in the thrall of it.
Definitely, it was full on Generation X, you know, at their peak. And there was a great energy there, you know, in them sort of early Britpop years and stuff like that, even if a lot of what people were doing doesn't really hold up or stand up. And I sort of loved the way my daughter's generation just shake their heads at it, and the whole edgelord thing.
Oh,
they came
yeah.
up with this fantastic insult just to dismiss sort of the entire 90s, where being edgy was, you know, hey, he's edgy. That was the thing to appeal to.
Edgelord. That's edgelord. Right. I only recently came across that term. And I think I came across it because I was thinking of rewatching Fight Club.
Ah, yeah.
And
yeah.
showing it to one of my sons who hadn't seen it before. And I said, oh, yeah, have you not seen Fight Club? Oh, it's worth seeing, I said, having not seen it since it came out.
Yeah.
And looked online and saw that there... Actually, I looked online after I saw it because I was interested to know, like, what is the legacy of this very odd film?
Yeah, yeah.
And the word edgelord came up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Because it really is quintessential edgelord movie making, isn't it?
But at the time, we thought it was so good. The Breakfast Club is another one.
Right. Yes, you talk about that in The Future Starts Here.
I do. It was the perfect eye-opening moment for me of, you know, our generation. It was a classic, you know, it was great. Had Molly Ringwald in it, it had Ali Sheedy in it. And then Generation Z sort of came along and it just looked at it with, like, horror. And it just makes no sense to their eyes, the way they view the world.
While I definitely agree that it is beyond cringy to watch now, I had to watch it through my fingers, and I certainly did think, like, what does this say about our generation? But I do remember thinking that there were certain aspects of it that were jarring at the time. Do you know?
The whole Ali Sheedy could only become desirable when she sort of dressed in a very sort of pink sort of way.
She became a girly girl.
But at the time, everybody hated that. You know, everybody liked the dandruff version of her much more. But it's more the, is it Bender? Is it Judd Nelson? Especially scenes like when he's under the table with Molly Ringwald and it sort of implied that he sort of touches her without her consent.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of casual sexual harassment going on.
Yeah, and he's such a bully that his tragic backstory, you know, doesn't compensate.
I really felt, though, that he was a bully because he'd been dealt a bad hand and life at home was so shit for him.
But in comparison to the nerd character, whose name escapes me now, Brian, I think he was called Brian, who towards the end is revealed attempted suicide the previous week.
Yes, because his parents' expectations were so high for him.
Yeah, and he seems to a modern audience to be what the heart of the story, you know, should be.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That feeling like, we're okay, the kids are all right, we're going to stand up to the terrible grown-ups. Because when you grow old, your heart dies.
Yes, that was very much the lesson that our generation received. And I sort of fully sort of took it on board.
Yeah. And what are those forces that make your heart die as you grow older? They are things like, well, they're compromises, aren't they? Financial pressures.
Giving up on dreams, expecting less, and all those things you're sort of seen as the norm. Mm. But they don't have to be.
No, definitely.
They don't have to be at all.
Who are the people that you admire who buck that trend that are alive today?
I don't know. I mean, David Lynch flashes into my mind immediately.
Yeah. It's generally sort of fine artists or artists of one kind or another, I suppose, isn't it? Because they're...
Yeah, I guess so. People who you wouldn't think there's an obvious place for them in the world, but they just do their stuff regardless, and a place sort of builds around them. There's a concept in ecology of niche creation, and the idea is it's not the case that a species will sort of come along and go, oh, I could do well here, there's lots of food and things like that, I'll take that. A species sort of comes along and just does his thing, and by acting in the world he sort of creates the very environment that he needs to survive. Mm-hmm. And it was when I made the decision to attempt to become a full-time writer, knowing full well the absurdity of it, given all the business models of writing and all that sort of stuff, there was a sort of an act of faith that if I just did it, people who read my books would start to appear. And slowly over time, I'd sort of build people who would go, oh, that guy's interesting, I'll read his next book. And just enough to support me, you sort of create the niche that you sort of need. It's not like the world was going, there's a real need for books by John Higgs. Where are they? You know, anything like that. But if you do them, then the world sort of reacts around you. And
Field of dreams, isn't it?
It's field of dreams. I mean, it's a tightrope.
If you build it, they will come.
Yeah. I mean, it's always on an edge of never quite working out properly. But, you know, it's, it was when I turned 40, that was when I made the decision to sort of, all right, I'm going to give it a go. Because I just had all these books building up in my head. Right. And you should never waste your midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. Right? You can do great things with a midlife crisis. If you just waste it on like a car, you know, it's just lack of imagination. Mine was the decision to know I will write books and attempt to sort of make a living there. And the option seemed to be, if I went for it, I'd be penniless. And if I didn't go for it, I'd be bitter. Mm. Right? I'd be bitter going forward.
Your heart would die.
Yeah. And like penniless certainly beats bitter. So I made the decision. And that was 10 years ago, and I'm still going, so, you know, so it's touch wood.
And so when you did start writing, I think your first book came out around 2007?
Yes, 2006, yes.
I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary.
Yeah.
Thereafter, you wrote about the KLF, Making Sense of the 20th Century, future starts here. These are some of the books you've written. You've recently written about William Blake. Is there something that you feel your books have in common? Is there an animating interest that started the whole process?
I think they all fit together. I think they all make total sense together. Yeah. But I'm quite prepared for no one else.
I feel as if there is, but I'm interested to know what you think that is.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's... I always try to offer some new perspectives. I don't try and sort of say, hey, this is how things are and this is how I see things. And there seems to me, there seems to be a lot of almost like open goals of just like all these amazing books and stories that no one else seems to bother writing. I still can't get over the fact that no one had written about the KLF for 17 years because it is the single most fascinating British music story of, you know, of my lifetime, certainly. And it was just sort of sitting there. And I'd say to, I know some music writers, and I'd say, oh, I'm writing a book about the KLF. And there was a pause, and they just went, why? You know, they just couldn't get their heads around why someone would do that. And that happens to a lot of my books. I had it with the Timothy Leary, with things like Watling Street. People go, why are you writing that? Until you've written it, and then people get it, and it's sort of like, oh, why didn't I think of, you know, doing that? To the extent that when I say, oh, this is my next book, and if people go, oh, great, I think, oh, that's not good. There's something wrong there. I had that with the William Blake. Everyone was like, oh, great, you're writing about William Blake. And I thought, that's worrying.
No, a lot of the figures that you're interested in have that, well, they're countercultural a lot of the time, and they are people who can be viewed from all sorts of different perspectives and mean a lot of different things to different people.
Yeah.
I suppose maybe one of the reasons people were bemused by your decision to write a book about the KLF was that in musical terms, if you just look at the music, it's fine, some of it's great, but it's not a substantial body of work, really, when you compare it to a lot of other artists.
Yeah.
What is fascinating is the story and the motivations of Bill Drummond and Jimmy Courtney and what they were up to. How much did you know about that when the music was coming out?
I didn't really pay much attention to them when the music was coming out. My thing was sort of more metal and paying attention to that sort of world at the time. But then they burnt the £1 million.
Right.
And I still remember, there was a big article about it in The Observer, just describing how they'd gone up to the island of Jura with their £1 million and gone to this tiny boathouse just after midnight on the 23rd of August and, you know, set fire to this money and couldn't really say why they'd sort of done it. And it's sort of just sort of stuck in my craw. You know, it's like if you understand something, it's very easy just to sort of move on, you know, forget about it and look at the next thing. But when something doesn't make sense, it's a real hint you're missing something.
And so your response to that was not to write them off as just nutters, as many people did.
Well, I certainly look at the notion that they're just nutters.
Yeah.
Or just attention-seeking arseholes, was, I think, it was a bit in the book of discussing whether they're just attention-seeking arseholes. Yeah. Don't dismiss that sort of side of it at all, but it's certainly not the whole thing. There's a lot of attention-seeking arseholes out there.
Yeah.
They don't really behave like that. They're behaving very sort of differently, I think.
Yeah. Because I watched a lot of interviews with them at the time, and there's one on an Irish chat show.
Oh, yeah, the Gay Byrne show.
Byrne, right, with Bill Drummond talking about it. And it's one of the few interviews where he is at least up for directly answering questions about why they burnt the £1 million.
Yeah, but their audience is so angry.
Yeah.
They're just furious.
But also Bill Drummond he doesn't have completely solid answers for it himself. You know?
No, not at all.
He's just kind of, well, it seemed like an interesting thing.
Yeah, and I mean, when I started writing the book, my assumption was, oh, I'll go and speak to them.
Yeah.
But the more I got into it and the more, you know, interviews with them that I read, the clearer it became that led nowhere. You know, they sort of couldn't tell you. It needed an entirely different sort of approach. And because they'd sort of done a tour and gone everywhere and asked for a response to what they were doing, I thought that sort of gave me permission just to write that book as it was and sort of put it out. And there's my response. Admittedly, it took me 17 years, but I feel justified doing that. There's not many stories about living people you do without, you know, trying to speak to them or anything like that. But that one seemed reasonable, I think.
Did you come to any conclusions? Did you feel differently about it after you'd written it?
Yeah, I mean, about 6 or 7 years ago, I sort of made the decision to stop doing talks about the KLF because it was kind of like that book was taking off more than I expected.
Right.
And the framing that it had was sort of being accepted more and more. And there was a sense that my voice was having undue weight because you just want everyone else to chip in and give their takes on it because it's a mystery to explore rather than, you know, a maths puzzle to solve.
It's one for the ages, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the... I was talking about it to James Acaster, the comedian.
Oh, yeah, excellent.
Because a friend of his... He'd got into a row about... Actually, they'd both been ranting about what a load of shit a lot of modern art was.
Yeah.
And KLF burning £1 million was one of... In fact, I think James mentioned it to his friend.
Oh, yeah.
Said, what
yeah.
do you think about that? And the guy just was spluttering with rage, which I totally get as a first response.
Yeah.
But I did think it was odd because it just seems like it's obvious that there's so much more to it. It's an act... that means so much on so many different levels and makes you think about so many different things. I thought it was odd to kind of just reject it out of hand as being evidence of how worthless art
you
is.
You could totally get a good book out of it.
That's yeah.
But going back to that argument with James Acaster about whether modern art is rubbish,
yeah.
a recommended practice in the sort of Discordian world, something Ken Campbell was very big on and Robert Anton Wilson, these are all figures that...
I was going to ask you about... Yeah, so for people... who don't know about Discordianism.
It was a 70s sort of pranksterish. It was also like a spoof religion that was also entirely serious. It was a way of being playful with doubt.
Yeah.
That is really healthy, I think, even though the absurdity of it, you know, can be a bit much for a lot of people. I kind of like all the sort of absurdity of it.
Yeah.
And, well, a good, given a sort of a good example, one of the things they'd recommend is just adopting a different belief every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say it's true, but you just sort of try it on and suppose and act as if it's true. And because I've got to write a thing in the new year about the Mutoid Waste Company, I'm sort of trying to get my head around that in the art world and where they sort of fit. I thought I'll just try on the idea that all modern art since about 1950 is just worthless.
Right.
It's just awful. And it turned out to be one of those belief systems that is very seductive. Once you put your head in it, it's sort of, it makes so much sense. And it's you almost loathe to sort of get out of it because it's also intellectual and it... what Blake would call eurism, it's all in that rational sort of thing, but it doesn't go any deeper. It doesn't, you know, affect you on a more profound level than previous art and stuff like that. And it started to make me things like I start to really admire video games just because of how visceral they were and just quite what an effect they had on you compared to sort of, you know, the chin stroking, you know.
Are you a gamer now?
I try to. I don't have a lot of time for them. And I do tend to be the more, you know, single players. I'm going through the Uncharteds at the moment and like Tomb Raiders and things like that.
Right.
And they're a bit murdery for me.
Yeah.
I'm not that desperate to murder people.
Because I was talking about video games with Vic Reeves on my podcast.
Oh, excellent.
And we both admitted to having an unreasonable prejudice that they were a total waste of time.
Yeah.
You know, like you play them and you feel guilty, like, I just wasted my time. I should have been reading a book or doing something else that would have been more edifying or educational somehow. And, of course, there are so many good things about video games. And as you say, there is the possibility that you can have something fairly unironic and direct.
Yes, that visceral thing I was sort of talking earlier. And sure, you can dismiss that as unnecessary or irrelevant. Or
it depends what game you're playing.
You're not being improved by it, put it that way. But it is definitely a thing.
Yeah.
And it is missing in a lot of art galleries or things like that, that sort of a piece of work having quite a profound effect on you.
Yes. I went to art school and I was at art school in the very early 90s. And
oh, yes.
It was full on postmodern a lot of the time.
Uh-huh.
And lots of sliding signifiers and talking about Derrida and...
Yes.
And it did drive me nuts, partly because I didn't understand a lot of it.
Yeah.
And partly because it just seemed so obviously a get-out for stuff that wasn't very good a lot of the time. You'd just talk about the theory behind it.
Yeah.
And people would roll their eyes if you couldn't do the jargon, you know. It's like, oh, well, you don't understand anyway, so...
Yeah.
So I was... I was conflicted because on the one hand, I felt excluded by these people who knew all the postmodern jargon.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, I liked The Simpsons. I liked the idea of taking things apart. And I liked the idea that there was no high art or low art. It was everything was just flattened out. Everything was relative. You know, you don't realize at that point where it's going to lead you.
Yes.
You don't realize that it's sort of a dead end if everything is just as important as everything else.
I guess that's a bit of a straw man description of postmodernism.
Sure.
The notion that because there are a lot of different perspectives and you have to try and reconcile them, you know, doesn't mean that they're all sort of equally worthless or equally worthy. But
I suppose the idea of irony, though, was something that I latched onto and I felt that was really coming through strongly in the 90s.
Definitely. That was the Generation X thing. That was the sort of the reaction to what had come before.
Yeah, because everything before was like, oh, that's cheesy. Anything straightforward or sentimental or direct or anything that might be self-consciously trying to improve things or teach you some kind of lesson or other. It was like, no, come on. Yeah. We're too cool for that. We're not going to do that.
Yeah. I tend to think of it as a Lovecraftian view of the world that you got in the 20th century. And it's in things like, say, Adam Curtis documentaries. Now,
yes.
Adam Curtis is great. He talks about a lot of interesting stuff. I'm all for his stuff. But he does have that very 20th century view of the world where the individual is this small sort of separate thing and the cosmos is incomprehensible and malevolent and scary and it's going to get you. And that's sort of this sort of automatic understanding of how things are. And there's a sort of paranoia there. It's quite a dark way of understanding things. And from what I can tell, it's sort of gone for the generation that's raised online. You can see it makes sense when people raise sort of passively in front of the TV. Mm-hmm. You're sat there, you're passive, all this thing's going on in front of you. There's nothing you can do. You can't control.
You're at the mercy of cosmic forces.
You're at the mercy of huge sort of forces that just don't have your best interests at heart. And that was that's that sort
and
of level.
Strange coincidences and strange alignments. Yeah. And
whereas if you see yourself as part of the all, which those raised online do seem to, that goes out the window. There's no separation between sort of you and everything. It means that you suddenly have a lot more responsibilities for your actions. You have to, you know, pay attention to sort of what they do, repercussions, and the whole sort of increase in things like anxiety and mental health problems seems highly connected with trying to sort of handle all this sort of extra responsibility of being a responsible part of the whole. There's been a massive fundamental shift, it seems to me, between the millennials and those born and raised in this sort of century.
That's always the way, though, isn't it?
There's always a sense of it, but on occasions there's a real shift. I mean, from the baby boomers to the Generation X to the millennials, there was just a gradual sort of shift. There was nothing fundamentally different about the way they understood the world. They reacted differently, had different priorities and things like that, but it all sort of fitted together. And I think it's taken people a bit of time to get their head around that there has been a similar sized shift now that we have, you know, digital natives sort of around. And a lot of the culture war that you get in right-wing newspapers, it's that real sort of sense that something has changed and they don't understand why and they don't understand what it is, and they can write, you know, lengthy op-eds about why it's bad and terrible, but because they don't really see the world in those terms. And you can see that rising sort of level of panic almost, even though, you know, the right, they've got, you know, they've got their candidate in number 10, they've got an 80-seat majority, they've got the hardest and most sort of ideological of Brexits, they've got everything they sort of possibly want, but there's this fear that really it's the end of them, that what we're seeing now is sort of the last lash of the dragon's tail, that there's that sort of that hyper-individual sort of way of looking at the world. It's a very different sense of a generation that's more involved. It's like the millennials didn't really vote compared to older people, but like the ones coming through now, they really can't wait to vote, you know, they're really, they're sort of really sort of a going to be turning up in droves, and I think it's going to be a bit of a shock to a lot of electoral people.
One of the things you write about in The Future Starts Here was even a friend of yours who decided that he was not going to look at the news for
yes,
a year.
That's right, yes.
I found that really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it throws up so much interesting stuff about to what extent it's productive to be engaged with things that are happening in areas that you might not necessarily be able to control. And yet, you know, the default feeling for most people, I think, now is that, especially on social media, is that you should be involved with these things. You should know about these things. You have a responsibility to be aware of what's happening in the world. And if you can, add your voice to the voices that want to change those things for the better.
It's whether consuming the news is the best way to achieve that. It's 'cause, I mean, I know as a writer that really what you're supposed to do, if you want to be sort of taken seriously, is to take the view that things are terrible and we're all doomed. And if you take that view, you're sort of given a certain credibility or gravitas. You're sort of taken seriously because that's what people on the news sort of say. You know, if you use all your imagination and wit to come up with a brand new perspective on why things are terrible to make so people know that things are sort of doomed, people will treat you well. I'm trying to think, what was that book? I Hate the Internet by Jared Kobeck or something like that. I think it's great. It's a really good book. It's very funny and it's very wise. But he basically almost forensically lists everything that's like bad about the internet. And, you know, you can't argue with him because he's right about all these things. It's everything sort of bad. But the moment you think, well, there you go then, the internet's bad, right? You've gone wrong, because there is also everything that's good about the internet. You know, there's people meeting the love of their lives on the internet. There's people's lives being changed and people learning. And there's a whole side of everything that's sort of good about it.
So what happened to your mate who shut himself off from the news then?
I think he had a much better time of it. And he, you know...
Because it wasn't as simple as like he... Because obviously certain things are unavoidable. You're going to find
it. I mean, he would say that anything he needed to know, it would come from talking to people. Mm-hmm. It's like if you sort of look at, say, last week's newspapers, you're sort of aware of like, wow, I really don't need to know 95% of this. 95% of this is just a waste of my time. And if I spent all that time worrying and fretting about, you know, that really isn't the sort of best use of my time. Whereas to understand, you know, reading a book on a subject will teach you far more about it than the froth of what's happening in the news. And I think a lot about something Barack Obama said, I think, was it 2016? It was something like that. He said, if you could choose any point in history to be born, but it had to be random, you know, you couldn't choose who your parents were, you wouldn't know if you'd be male or female or what colour skin you'd have, or whether you'd be gay or straight or rich or poor or anything like that. It was entirely random. If you could choose any point in time to be born, you would choose now. And, you know, if you look at all the statistics of access to healthcare, access to education, childhood poverty, all these sort of things, he's right. He's dead right. You know, you totally would choose now. But it sounds so weird. It sounds so strange that the notion that now is the best point in history to be born, when our media thing is like, no, this is the worst. This is the worst it's ever been. You know, this is, and tomorrow will be even worse. But now is the worst, you know.
I guess people are skeptical when you put things in positive terms because they worry that it will discourage people from trying to put right the things that are wrong.
Yeah, well, yes.
Make them complacent somehow.
There's a big difference between blind optimism and pragmatic optimism. Yeah. You know, blind optimism ain't going to work out. That's not, you know, just the automatic assumption everything's going to be fine. Just that's not a good move. But sort of making the decision to view things from a more optimistic than a pessimistic way, just statistically, just the maths of it, is going to have a positive effect, because you will come up with all sorts of possible solutions to problems, which, you know, most of which will be awful and most of which will be nonsense, compared to if you just assume that we're all doomed and there's nothing you can do.
You know, one of the obvious problems with having that kind of we're all fucked attitude is that it poisons the future, or it puts it at a disadvantage. The idea that you might be able to imagine a better future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is a big, important part of making that future happen.
Absolutely. If you can't imagine a better future, then sort of how are you going to sort of build it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can see that shift in sci-fi, which I suppose originally, I guess after the Second World War, they were very consciously trying to be positive with their sci-fi. And
it was exciting. Yeah. The future would be exciting. Right. Imagine being in the future. That was the
We will have solved all the problems. Yeah. There'll be flying cars everywhere. It's going to look like a really big shopping mall. Well, that came true. But, you know, and there were films like 2001 and then shows like Star Trek and Star Trek The Next Generation, which I really loved. And then it seemed that after Star Trek The Next Generation, which was all warm, like everything about it was warm, all the colors on the Enterprise, it was all sort of warm orange, red, yellow hues and things on the uniforms and everything.
Yeah.
And it was all very much like, we're going to sort this out. Good kind of very diverse crew. And a lot of the problems had been sorted. And then you get Deep Space Nine, which was much darker, and they're dealing with terrorism and racism much more directly and things like that.
It's the thing that sums up for me is the no smoking sign on the bridge of the Enterprise. There's a no smoking sign. And there was a huge row about it. I think Gene Roddenberry was being edged out because they spent so much on the first film.
Is there a no smoking sign?
I think they got made it. So the director had put it there.
Yeah.
And Gene Roddenberry had been like, oh, you don't understand. People are getting better. People are improving. In the future, people are better than they are now. People on spaceships wouldn't be smoking. You don't need to put a no smoking sign on the Enterprise. And of course, we know now that, you know, since the early 80s, smoking has just collapsed completely. And, you know, you'd really be surprised to find an ashtray on a spaceship these days. People would not be smoking. Gene Roddenberry was exactly right. But there was that sort of tussle for, yeah, it was that shift that you're talking about. Became a point where there was just no positive visions of the future in our culture anywhere. And the last one I could find when I went looking for one was like Bill and Ted, because like the future had great water slides. That was the best that they could come up with. That was the best that they could do.
Well, there was an odd film that you referenced towards the beginning of The Future Starts Here, which is called Tomorrowland, directed by Brad Bird.
Yeah.
Who did The Incredibles and Ratatouille. And it starred George Clooney. And it was a flop, basically.
Yeah.
It was quite an
People
expensive
People didn't want it at all.
Film. No.
Yeah.
It's not a great film, but there's a lot of great things in it.
It's an interesting film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely confused, but he's definitely trying to wrestle with exactly this. Like, if we can't imagine a positive future, then we're in trouble. And the whole plot, as confused as it is an expression of that idea.
Yeah,
it climaxes with the villain played by Hugh Laurie, who has, spoiler, basically invented a sort of machine, I think, which is, it's able to see into the future. I'm getting this wrong, podcasts, but it's something like this. Somehow they've been able to see into the future. They see a big calamity for the human race. So they start trying to warn everyone that time is running out and the earth is going to perish in order to shake them up.
Yeah.
And to give them a scare, but it has the opposite effect, right?
Yeah.
And he says at one point, the probability of widespread annihilation kept going up. The only way to stop it was to show it, to scare people straight, because what reasonable human being wouldn't be galvanized by the potential destruction of everything they've ever known or loved? To save civilization, I would show its collapse. But they gobbled it up like a chocolate eclair. They didn't fear their demise. They repackaged it to be enjoyed as video games, TV shows, books, and movies. The entire world wholeheartedly embraced the apocalypse and sprinted towards it with gleeful abandon. Meanwhile, your earth was crumbling all around you. Yeah. But it is. I recommend it to people who haven't seen it. It's a weird film. And that speech that I just quoted a little bit from, I found this blog post from someone who was saying, oh, when Hugh Laurie, this was a negative response to it. He said, I facepalmed when I saw that. When Laurie gives that speech in Tomorrowland, he's speaking to a global audience of powerless wage slaves who are living in fear and struggling just to survive. I.e., this is the reality of the audience. Most people can't afford their own home or education, much less build a utopian city. Telling the average person that it's their fault the world is burning is blaming the victim.
Hmm.
So there's also that response to those efforts to be positive, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see those two viewpoints as contradictory in any way.
Yeah.
I think they fit together quite well. Yeah, definitely.
I'm checking my account at the memory bank. The memory bank, the memory bank. We're thanking you for banking all your memories. I'd like to take out a happy memory, thanks. The memory bank, the memory bank. Oh, I'm sorry, but you're very overdrawn. I will repay with interest when I get back up on my happy feet. The memory bank, the memory bank. I'm very sorry, but we're closing your account.
My what? Where am I?
The memory bank, the memory bank. We're the nice bank. Would you like to bank with us?
There's always so many little details and references, perhaps because we're a similar age, in your books that are really resonant. And one of the things that you mention, maybe even in The Future Starts Here Again, you talk about Johnny Rotten's eyes. Is that in there?
Oh, God, when did I mention Johnny Rotten's eyes?
Look at a picture of Johnny Rotten in 1976. Look into his eyes and you'll see something extraordinary is going
that,
on.
I think that was an argument against pure materialism or something that sort of... It was something like that. I can't remember when I didn't write down
in what context it came in, but just that line made me think, yeah.
Yeah.
There is something really extraordinary in there, isn't there? And also...
It's the sort of thing that you can't measure.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a lot of perspectives, it's not real. Some people say, well, you can't measure it. It's sort of not real. And it really is real, isn't it? That thing in Johnny Rotten's eyes. You know, you can't cut things like that out of your sort of worldview.
Obviously, with him, it's weird because he's turned into such a different character now in so many ways.
Yeah, it's quite funny the way that for our generation, punk was untouchable.
Hmm.
It was in credibility, in cool. It was. There's no argument it was punk, you know. And again, for the generation that's growing up complaining about edgelords, it's just sort of some real sort of Brexity sort of, you know, Johnny Rotten, Julie Burchill.
Yeah,
you know,
it's old fart culture.
It's old fart culture, and it's embarrassing to them, you know, and that sort of so edgy and so rebellious and things like that.
But again, I'm sure that's bound to be the way, though, isn't it? That's just the natural order of things.
Yeah, it is.
Everything edgy ends up looking a bit daft.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's just interesting to see it happen so quickly, you know.
Yeah. But as you say, when you look back at those pictures in 1976 and you're able to transport yourself back in some way to the moment when he was like that, when he was staring out in that way, and you just thought, whoa.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. I was trying to think about some of the best things about modern life. Like, we've talked about some of them. We've talked about the ways that maybe attitudes are shifting for younger generations. But what about on like a superficial level? Can you think of some of the things that, some of the moments where you think, oh, this is good. Modern life's working. I think about it every time I use the maps on my phone.
Yes, that's right.
This is good. All right, this phone is, there's lots of bad things about it, but this is good.
I think it's been quite a buzz to ride the rise of the internet and just see it build slowly and slowly. I remember the first time I got maps up on my phone. I was on a bus. I was in a bus going across London. I was trying to work out where to get off and this thing. And I was looking at this map, and then suddenly this blue dot appeared on this road. And what's this blue dot? And I realised that it was me, that I was being tracked on the map. And suddenly that was like mind-blowing. That was the first time that happened.
Yeah.
That was just amazing.
Rather than staring at the A to Z, I used to cycle around London the whole time with my A to Z. And if I ever left my A to Z behind, it would be like, now what am I going to do?
Yeah.
I'm just not going to be able to go where I want to go.
I have to ask someone.
Yeah. Or phone up and write down the directions.
Yeah. It's just those moments when you just sort of, you know, you've got all of recorded music there. And also you can give it to your children.
Mm-hmm.
You get a family Spotify thing and you go, here you are, both my children. Here is all of recorded music. And you remember what it was like to be shifting through the bins in, you know, back of Chester Market and you're, as a teenager trying to find the thing.
Yeah.
And
although I'm conflicted about that one because I like the hunt.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And the feeling of achievement when you track something down. In the old days, John, you'd hear something on the radio or on a TV ad or something. You're like, what was that?
But if you could go back to that, if say someone said, I could take away Spotify, so you can't have Spotify, how would you react to that?
Fine.
You'd be all right about
it? I really think I would be all right with it, because I genuinely believe that the connection that I had with the music that I was discovering.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so hard, this, isn't it? Because I was a different person. I was young.
Sure.
Everything was different. But I do remember so vividly the feeling of elation when I would track these things down, when I would go to Paris and I would find that they had these Brian Eno albums that you couldn't get in the UK.
Uh-huh.
And it would be like, whoa, so exciting. And then you'd listen to it. And I found a copy of My Life in the Bush of Ghosts in New York and Tower Records that had this track called Curran that was later deleted from further pressings because it was offensive to the Muslim community because it had part of the Quran in it. And it was like, wow, this is exciting.
Yeah.
And that.
Yeah,
that,
you sell it well. You make a good point.
However, you know, as you say, wonderful to be able to just include the children on my Spotify account, and off they go on their journeys of discovery.
And you can watch their journeys of discovery. Yeah. And how, I mean, after anything like my kids, their musical knowledge is encyclopedic now. It's just extraordinary. They've just sucked up 50 years of music and worked out what was good and what was of value. And, you know, it's fascinating to see them.
Yes, and they're making leaps and connections that I was never able to make. That's one of the really fun things I think about streaming online music. Are there things that you return to prevent you from becoming cynical or becoming dragged down by the negative aspects of modern life?
Well, I mean, I'm not against being dragged down by the negative aspects of modern life. I was at a talk recently and a guy came up to me, and again he was talking about the Future Starts Here book and just how important it was to him, and I, not really thinking, just said, I'd hope to one day write a really sort of book that's full of like proper Welsh despair. And his face just sort of fell when I said that. what have I said? But my thinking being that, you know, if we get that balance of light and dark back in the culture, then I can explore all of it, you know. It just seems irresponsible just to sort of keep stoking the dark, because when you write something and you put it out there, it does have an effect, and to some extent it's, you can't predict what it will be, but you are in some way responsible for it. And if you write the thing that successfully tips someone into a pit of despair, then that's kind of on you. So, yeah, the proper Welsh despair book is some distance away yet. I mean, I'm writing the book at the moment about the Beatles and James Bond.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been quite a ride. I don't know if you've seen the latest James Bond film.
No, have you?
Yeah.
How was it?
Going in without spoilers is one of the, will be one of the key cinema experiences in your life.
Yeah.
So go see it soon. But basically, they're twins, essentially. They're both born on the same day. They're born on the 5th of October, 1962. It was like a Friday afternoon.
Bond and the Beatles.
Yeah, the first Bond film, Dr. No, and the first Beatles record came out on the same day. And Beatles are basically love, and Bond is basically death. And, you know, Freudian thoughts, you know, Eros and Thanatos, these are the two competing drives. And neither story makes any sense compared to normal entertainment rules. You know, you don't create a film character that's still going strong 60 years later. Many have tried. It doesn't happen. It's just impossible. And no four musicians can do what the Beatles did in 8 years. It's just, they're just insane stories. But when you put them together, they're kind of these two different aspects of the British psyche playing out on a global stage. They sort of highlight so many different and weird and interesting, well, things like class come up an awful lot in this sort of thing. The thing that sort of set me off on it was a thing Hanif Qureshi wrote about how at school he'd been told that the Beatles didn't write their own music because they couldn't, because they were just like some scallies from Liverpool. They hadn't gone to the right schools. There was no way they could sort of do it. It had to be George Martin and Brian Epstein. He was taught this at school. And I could sort of now get how, for that generation who had that sort of background, did believe that because they'd gone to these schools, they were superior. It just created such cognitive dissonance in the British establishment by being, you know, just so much better and so much more talented, so much more original, and so much compared to what anyone else could do.
Yeah,
the country had to sort of revise how it understood, you know, how people were and how it thought. So just telling these two stories together over this sort of period just keeps throwing up all these fascinating insights into Britain, also male identity, what it means to be a man. Because like something like James Bond is, he's supposed to be everything that's good about being male, but he's also everything that's terrible about being male. All of
he's Ian toxic.
Fleming's toxic sort of stuff is sort of there.
Yeah.
But they're sort of put together and sort of brought into the light in a way that strangely, if you watch how he changes sort of over time, specifically the past 15 years or so, it is telling you a lot about how we are changing and how we are getting better. Yeah, it's just some of it at the start. My God, have you read any?
I've never read an actual
Goldfinger's
Fleming
worst.
Book. Is
oh,
it?
Holy cow. Just in terms of like racism and, and the belief that Ian Fleming seems to believe that lesbians because they were assaulted as young girls, but they need a real man and they will cure them. And
right.
He's writing this. And the racism towards Koreans in that book is just astonishing. Anyway, it's an example of how much we've changed and how much we are getting better, even though we, you know, don't always see it, we don't always recognise it, we don't always appreciate it.
Yeah.
Is going from, you know, Ian Fleming's books to No Time to Die is a good example.
What do you think John Lennon would be like if he were alive today?
Oh, it's a very good question. He really was that sort of wounded healer sort of archetype. He's a very strange, specific thing. And there's a, well, you might know about this, boarding school syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of boarding school syndrome as a concept out of interest?
I think you can over-egg it.
Yeah.
But I think there's got to be a lot that rings true about it. How could it not be? You put a child through a traumatic experience if they love their parents very much and they love being at home, as a lot of children do, not all. And then to suddenly be wrenched out of that and have that relationship completely erased.
Absolutely. Because Ian Fleming had that and became this very, very damaged and emotionally stunted individual. But John Lennon, when he was taken from his mother and given to his aunt, also seems to have had a very similar thing and this having the similar sort of emotional sort of damage into his life. Because it wasn't that his mother lacked love. If you read Julia Baird's book, John Lennon's Sister, you know, she paints a really lovely account of her mother, and she probably needed help and support, but, you know, she certainly loved her children, and she could, and she was a wonderful mother to them. But though she didn't lack love, she lacked respectability because of having children out of wedlock after the husband had gone and all this sort of stuff. So Lennon was taken and given to his aunt, and it's a very similar thing to being sent to boarding school. That sort of, they talk about it in terms of how it's a mistake to talk in terms of homesickness, because it's a much deeper thing like than that. It's closer to grief. You've been sort of exiled, you've been sort of sent away from what you thought was home to a place where there is no love and there is possibly bullying and cold things like that, and how it affected that. Because, you know, obviously Paul McCartney lost his mum. She had breast cancer. She died. It was tragic. It affected him. But there's no blame. We understand it, and we understand the impact it had on him. The Lennon thing was much more strange and much more complicated. Yeah. Yeah, and as I say, he sort of became very much this damaged, violent, wild thing in Liverpool who tried to become this icon of peace. And it, you know, he was always flawed. But the journey in itself is important, is significant, I think. Yeah, so I don't know what he'd be like now. I'm slightly scared.
Yeah. He'd be well into the dark web, wouldn't he?
It's the, you know, that sort of world of conspiracies out there is so joyless. Conspiracies used to be like, oh, yeah, Stanley Kubrick, like, made the film Landings, and the Atlantis did this, and the aliens made the pyramids. They were sort of wild and
fun. They were fun.
They were fun. They were really fun. They may have been nonsense. Occasionally you learn something new from them. You know, Graham Hancock was off searching for Atlantis, and he's the one who sort of raised the idea that a lot of Bronze Age civilizations were on the coast, which is underwater now, so you have to go there to find them. And that's been a positive and sort of useful thing from having all these wild ideas about sort of Atlantis. But the world of conspiracies is all, it's just this paranoia. It's just this sort of, you're a victim and they're going to get you. And it's just...
Well, wasn't that part of Discordianism? Weren't some of those people in there responsible for coming up with the Illuminati conspiracy?
Definitely, yeah. It's all,
as a prank.
But I would... How I see Discordianism is it's essentially an antidote to all this conspiracy mm-hmm. world. It sort of teaches you not to believe it. You might be interested in it. You might be entertained by it. You might be knowledgeable about it. You ain't going to fall for it. And at the moment, you're seeing a lot of people falling left, right and centre. And especially, as I said earlier, you know, when people have not been going to the pub and speaking to people face to face, people have been getting sucked into these sort of reality tunnels and struggling and drowning in them. And those who've read Robert Anton Wilson haven't been doing that. It teaches you never to properly believe these things, you know, and that's very valuable sort of, you know, the worth of doubt. Doubt is a great thing. We always thought doubt is terrible. Doubt's a superpower. Doubt's a wonderful thing.
Yes, there was a thing I wrote down from one of your books where you talk about if you want to be certain about something, buy an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
And
if you want to never be certain, buy two encyclopedias.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that is maybe the thing that I like so much about your books is that you're all about doubt and the danger of certainty and the value in considering other perspectives. And
I mean, Blake writes a lot about the side of the brain, which he refers to as urizen, which is the rational sort of side. And it's a model of the world and how things are, but it's insecure and it has to be proved right. It wants other people to see the world in the same way that it does, and it will start all sorts of crusades and fights. And you just go on Twitter and you'll see all these people desperately sort of their vision is the correct one. But you know, there's nearly 7 billion, there's over 7 billion people on the planet, and you're never going to find someone who sees the world exactly the same way that you do on every level. You're never going to find them. It must make you question your worldview. It must do. You know, you have to accept that I must be, you know, out on quite a few things here and there, and I don't know what they are because we all have this blind spot. And accepting that and being comfortable with it.
Yeah, that's the challenge.
It's being comfortable with it. And sort of, I feel I'm quite good at being okay about people, you know, seeing the world very differently to what I do. And I'm happy with that. I don't expect it to be anything. That's just how things are. People have all these different sort of perspectives. And you can learn bits from other people, you know, cutting them off and calling them and designate them as the baddies and sort of hating them and fighting them. Yeah, you ain't going to advance or learn from doing that. You need to be able to sort of put your head in other people's spaces. And when you get into that fundamentalist route, you can no longer do it and you're doomed. It's, was it Robert Anton Wilson put it as, convictions create convicts. You know, what you believe imprisons you. And Blake would talk about the mind forged manacles, and it's all that sort of, the need to be free of that. Because it ain't going to do you any good. And as I say, you're only here on this planet for so many decades. And these are unnecessary ways to bind you and make your life just a fraction of, you know, what it could be. So, totally down for a little bit of doubt.
Wait.
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul. And I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts. And I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh.
But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Chicks, can I hold a smoke? That's what it is.
Hey, welcome back, Podcats. That was John Higgs talking to me there. Really enjoyed meeting John and getting the chance to talk to him, having enjoyed so many of his books very much over the years. The one that really got me into his stuff is The Future Starts Here, Adventures in the 21st Century, but the KLF book is fantastic as well, as is the William Blake. Well, he's written two on William Blake, I think. William Blake Now, Why He Matters More Than Ever, and William Blake Versus the World, which has just come out in paperback, I think. I also really enjoyed Stranger Than We Can Imagine, Making Sense of the 20th Century. I haven't read the Timothy Leary book that John wrote from 2007, but it's on my list. There's a few links in the description of the podcast to a talk with John conducted by Robin Ince about William Blake. And there's a link to that interview with Alan Moore about Robert Anton Wilson and the Illuminatus trilogy and conspiracy theories and all that kind of stuff. I have now seen the last James Bond film. I found that it was quite controversial among some of my friends. A few of them liked it. Some of them really didn't like it. But it caught me in the right mood. And I enjoyed it a lot, actually. More than The Batman, which we sat around and watched last night as a family here at Castle Buckles. It was fine, but I think it could have been a little longer. I mean, I don't think 3 hours is really long enough to properly tell a story about a sad emo guy in a magic costume that repels bullets and explosions. No, it's complicated stuff, and you need at least 4 hours, I would say, to deal with that. Also, I think it should have been more darker, because I could make out a couple of things in certain scenes. You know, sometimes when you have those dystopian, dark visions of cityscapes, Blade Runner style, what they do is they enable you to actually see what's going on. Lights, etc., neon lights, that kind of thing, to provide more detail in the visuals. But luckily they didn't do that in The Batman, and it was all just murky. That was the main thing, murky, and everyone was sad, especially the Batman. He's very sad. Speaking of movies, we've got links to a film that's been made by a couple of people I know a little bit and like. David Earle, a.k.a. Brian Gittins. David is an actor, comedian, who pops up in some of Ricky Gervais's TV shows. And his friend Rupert Magendy. Anyway, they've made a film called Brian and Charles, written by David Earle and Chris Hayward, who both star in the film, along with the very talented Louise Brealey. After dealing with a particularly harsh winter, Brian, an inventor living in rural Wales, decides to lift himself out of a depression by building a robot companion called Charles. Now, they actually made a short film called Brian and Charles, and I've put a link to that in the description. When did they do that? 2017. So that was the first incarnation of what has now turned into a feature-length film, a comedy, a quirky comedy, which I haven't seen yet, but I did see the short, liked it very much. So if you're looking for something to go and see at the movies that isn't very dark, 4 hours long, with no smiling, then I encourage you to go out and support Brian and Charles. Okay, that's it for this week, I think. Thank you very much indeed to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for his work on this episode. Thanks to Ben Tullow for conversation editing. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Seamus. Thanks to Helen Green. She does the artwork for this podcast. Thanks to all the people who helped me at Acast. Rosie! Come on, let's head back. Come on. But thanks most of all, as ever, to you for listening to the whole podcast and getting to this point. Only about a quarter of people. I know I'm not supposed to admit this, but, you know, not everybody listens to the whole podcast. You are part of an elite force, the Quartermasters, and I'm very grateful. Hey, would you like a hug? Absolutely, you don't need to have it. It's just a bonus if you're feeling like it would be nice. Okay, here we go. I'm leaning in right now. I'm leaning in, coming over the left shoulder. What's happening? Hey. All right, look, go carefully out there. Thanks again. And for what it's worth, I love you. Bye!